Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie, a show where two film professors talk about movies. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about writer and director Richard Curtis, who is from Wellington, New Zealand, and you know went to Oxford University with a first in English language and literature. And when he was in college, his girlfriend left him for a man named Bernard. So in each of his screenplays, there is a fairly unpopular character named Bernard. So if you haven't noticed that before and you go back to rewatch any of his movies, make sure you look for that because that's always, you know, good for a laugh. As a child, he lived in New Zealand, the Philippines, and Sweden because his father was an executive of Unilever who was posted around the world. And I think this gives him an edge just in terms of just different perspectives, you know, living on two different islands that are radically different from each other. And then, you know, Sweden in the middle of Europe. I mean, that's just a lot of exposure to different cultures just from the get-go. He also founded Comic Relief with Lenny Henry and is a lifelong aficionado on just about anything connected to the Beatles, which of course we will get to. So Mike, any intro stuff you want to start off with about Richard Curtis before we get into his movie career?
Yeah, let's talk about Richard Curtis as Richard Curtis, if you will. It's not a name that's necessarily well known to the movie going public. People will know his films, but it's not a star name. By that, I mean, you know, there are certain directors and you know, producers and so on where the name itself becomes really well known. And I think there are a few reasons for that. One of them is that when you look at Richard Curtis's early career, his background was primarily as a screenwriter and producer and then segued into the director's chair. And it seems to me that, you know, people may admire a film and like it a lot, but how many people will even know the name of a screenwriter, right? Let's be honest there. Like, there aren't that many screenwriters who are known, you know, by name that way, much less like with a producer. You know, you read that credit and it doesn't register, and why should it in most cases? And so in terms of Richard Curtis, he's always listed as screenwriter, producer, director. His greatest strength actually is as a screenwriter. His films are functionally well-made. I'm not, speaking ill of them that way, but there are any number of people who would direct these films. It's the screenplays that have a certain consistency and, in terms of comic outlook and so on. And that's the screenwriter hat, where he knows how to write a certain kind of comedy. And even if people don't always know the name Richard Curtis, you start mentioning film titles, as we will in the next few minutes, and it's like, oh, I like that. Oh, that too. Did he do that too? You know, and you kind of connect the dots that way and you realize, yes, it's a very full career. Secondly, the second hat, if you will, as producer, the fact that he works with a lot of the same actors and extremely well, and he's smart that way. You know, you have your friends who are, you know, your acting friends, and you do a film together, and then it's like, well, let's do another one. You know, and a year or two later, you're reunited that way, a really consistent streak that way. It accounts for his being so prolific, I think, is that he's writing his own screenplays, working with the same actors and so on. And again, that third hat as director, he's fine. I mean, he's a competent director. I'm not, you know, again, bad-mouthing anyway, but I think any number of people could direct those scripts. And in fact, in many of his films, or at least some of the films, you know, he's directing, and other films, somebody else has that hat. So he knows, you know, occasionally to hand that off that way. And I think really the film to talk about where I first became aware of him, and I want to get Marie's input on this as well, was a film called The Tall Guy in 1989. Why don't you talk about that a bit if you want? And I certainly have some things I'd like to say as well.
I am not familiar with that movie. My first intro to him was Four Weddings and a Funeral from 1994. But I did want to say, Mike, I'm so glad that you mentioned that his strength is really in the writing, not necessarily in the directing. He's not a bad director. There's nothing wrong with the movies. But the strength is definitely in the writing. And in fact, you know, if you don't pay attention to things before you go see things, like sometimes I'll just go into a movie cold without looking up anything about it. You know, you go back and think, wow, I really liked that script. If you look it up, it'll be Richard Curtis. But I just want to say before I give it back to you on that movie, he did say he didn't decide to be a writer. He wanted to be an actor and turned out to be very bland. So he said, I would always get cast as a character from Twelfth Night called Fabian, who hides behind the hedge and doesn't have any funny lines. So I decided I would have to write my own lines. So take it away, Mike, and I'll take it back with Four Weddings and a Funeral when you're done with that. What do you want to say about that?
You know, again, I don't want to sound snide in talking about him as a director, but as a director, he knows how to shoot the dialogue well. You know, and again, I'm trying to say that in a straightforward way, that, you know, he writes pretty tight scripts. I mean, he's got a good sense of comic timing. And as a director, he gets out of his own way. You know what I mean? He just knows the actors are competent. They're doing their lines. Just cut from one to the other. You know, you don't need any fancy camera work. And it's very functional camera work. And that's fine. Very straightforward. Now, the film I think that really gets him launched, as I mentioned a moment ago, is called The Tall Guy from 1989. Somebody else directs it. He's simply the screenwriter here. And the premise of it is that Jeff Goldblum plays an actor who's appearing in a musical version of the very serious Broadway play, The Elephant Man. And, you know, I mean, The Elephant Man, you know, many people know it through the David Lynch film version of it, but, you know, very serious material about a man with a horrible physical condition in the 19th century and, you know, his travails in Victorian society. But what's funny about this film, it's in the premise. It's a very funny premise. Take this super serious material. We have to be like really careful, kid glove treatment, like, you know, how you as a writer and director are going to deal with this man who was basically like a sideshow freak to Victorian society. Obviously, you're sympathetic, but how do you actually shoot that? How do you handle it? Well, in The Tall Guy, they go goofy with it and you can just giggle. All you can do is like giggle after. There's a difference between like laughing and giggling. This is a giggling movie. You just kind of giggle at it because what they do is they take the Elephant Man, which again, I've seen the Broadway play long before I saw the film. And you know, it's really serious material. And they turn it into this musical called Elephant, the Musical, with an exclamation point there at the end. It's almost like, you know, somehow like as if like Andrew Lloyd Webber or something got a hold of it and decided to do a big glitzy musical out of it. Now, the reason in particular I want to mention is twofold. One is that Richard Curtis, our guy to talk about today, did the screenplay for that. Okay. And this goes all the way back to 1989. Secondly, though, look at the casting in it. The cast includes Emma Thompson, Rowan Atkinson, and Geraldine James. And in the rest of our segment today, we'll spend a lot of time talking about the actors he's worked with, including people like Rowan Atkinson. I mean, people who really have been stalwarts for him. They're part of, it's almost like an acting company. And that movie, again, it got some attention when it came out because of the talent attached and the premise. Well, it's not a great comedy, but it's a good giggle comedy, as I would call it. And that, I think, is one of the early screen credits for him that leads up to something like Four Weddings and a Funeral from 1994. And as Marie will be telling us more about, I mean, that really is the film that truly launches him. You're absolutely right. That's the film where if you didn't know him at all before, that's the film that did incredibly well at the box office, you know, both in the UK and in the US and elsewhere. And people really like it a lot. And in fact, so much so that Richard Curtis himself received an Academy Award nomination for Best Original Screenplay. So think about that. He's a relatively unknown talent. And here he is getting an Oscar nomination for Best Original Screenplay. Again, his strength is in the writing.
And it's a great role for Rowan Atkinson, who you mentioned he likes using in his movies. And he's hilarious in this. He said he was inspired by this movie when he was, you know, going through some old diaries and realized he'd been to 72 weddings in 10 years. I think anything with weddings in it is immediately popular for some people. I think that that's just a great topic to build a story around, no matter who makes it. But of course he does, you know, his thing with the ensemble cast, which I think he is really good choice. It's very strong with his writing. He's able to weave stories that involve people who are involved with each other's lives in ways they're not aware of. And he does that just very well in this movie, which, by the way, the first British movie to win a César, the French equivalent of the Oscar for Best Foreign Film and Best Original Screenplay. That's just tells you how good it had to be for it to have gotten that far. While making the movie, Hugh Grant thought the movie was awful. So it kind of gives you an idea for, you know, sometimes when you're working on something, even though you have the great dialogue, it really does really come down to some editing as well to make something that is good, actually great. And then, you know, what would follow Four Weddings and a Funeral is 2003's Love Actually. But before I start talking about that, Mike, do you have anything more you wanted to say about Four Weddings?
Yeah, I do actually. I mean, I enjoyed it when it came out and I liked it primarily for the silly quality. He's a good silly writer. He writes, you know, I keep using the word goofy, silly. I mean, oftentimes romantic comedies that play off of serious themes, you know, weddings, funerals and all that, but do it in such a light and kind of jovial way. What makes it really work, I think, is that twofold thing. It's the writing, which, you know, I mean, he's not my favorite screenwriter, but I'm acknowledging he's got that skill set. He writes good, light, you know, banter-filled dialogue. And secondly, as we've been saying, he knows how to work with really good actors and work with them again and again. Hugh Grant certainly will be a constant for him. Andy McDowell, you know, is fine in this. And Rowan Atkinson, who plays a minister in Four Weddings and a Funeral. I mean, just, you know, the moment you see him, you start to smile, right? Or giggle even, because he's just a funny looking actor. The other thing I would add, and it should be added actually in any discussion of Four Weddings and a Funeral, is again, something that's behind the screen, off screen. One reason why the general public still might not have known his name per se, though certainly the Academy Award nomination for Best Original Screenplay helped. But, you know, how many people, you know, and I don't mean this in a disparaging way, but, you know, we go to see movie stars, we go to see, you know, or star director, if you will, but we don't tend to think about screenwriters quite as much. But the fact that in addition to being the screenwriter of Four Weddings and a Funeral in 1994, he was a co-producer of the film. That's really important. If you look at his filmography from that point onward, almost always he is a producer, a co-producer. He's controlling the show, folks. You know, I mean, he's not just doing the screenplay and helping with things, you know, by way of working with familiar actors and recommending them. No, he's actually the producer who hires them. He controls that hiring process, if you will. And case in point there is, after Four Weddings and a Funeral, 3 years later, he makes Bean in 1997, again, working with Rowan Atkinson, and he does the screenplay. He's also the co-producer. And in that film, Rowan Atkinson plays a very sleepy museum guard who ends up with Whistler's mother. And if you want to find out the details there, you got to watch the film. You know, it's a film I enjoyed. I mean, I don't put it on the top shelf of like great comedies, but, you know, I smiled and laughed as I watched it. I liked it. I enjoyed it. And Rowan Atkinson just, again, has that almost silent screen quality of, he just sets a stand there. He looks stupid, right? And in this case, he's playing a stupid character. So it's perfect. And I love the way in which the New York Times, in reviewing Bean, referred to the Rowan Atkinson character, and that is, quote unquote, an infantile nerd. And that's a really good description of how Rowan Atkinson works, right? Because he has this nerdish quality. If he's playing like a museum guard or a bureaucrat or whatever, you know, he might even be like in coat and tie and kind of full of himself and, you know, self-important person, whatever, but that he's got an infantile quality, that he's really immature. And again, it's like almost like an overgrown child. And that's another connection with some of the silent screen comedians where, you know, some of them are, strictly speaking, you know, playing adult characters, but they might have like a childish quality to a Fatty Arbuckle type actors, where they might have like almost like childish quality to them. And you think, gee, you know, he's like a 5-year-old, but in a 25-year-old's body, that kind of a thing. And not just in silent film, but we can think of, you know, in more recent decades, comedians have had that quality of, you know, playing really goofy, immature characters. And I think Rowan Atkinson has that just somehow wired within him to play, you know, these really, really slow-witted, you know, who just will stumble into a scene and everything's going to go wrong there. And almost to the, like, what I call the Peter Sellers, you know, Pink Panther kind of level of, you know, you're going to slip on the banana peel. It's going to set off a concatenation of mishaps. And it just escalates almost in a theme park way of how much can go wrong and how it builds. But in terms of building a career, Richard Curtis knew, as a co-producer as much as a screenwriter, when you're working with, you know, Hugh Grant or Rowan Atkinson, people like that, just keep working with them. I mean, this is like, you know, how certain producers and directors and screenwriters just have a kind of chemistry with the talent on screen. And so I think he's really savvy that way. And you're absolutely right, Marie. You know, that those are some of the early roles that or screenwriting opportunities that provide great roles for actors and really propel the career. So let me hand off to you at this point.
I love that infantile nerd. That is Mr. Bean all over. It also reminds me of a great way to describe Pee Wee Herman. He also mines a little bit of that infantile nerd kind of thing. In Love Actually, Rowan Atkinson plays a jewelry salesman. He was supposed to be an angel and disappear as he walks away from Daniel at the airport scene, but they just sort of allude to that instead of like actually showing that. This does have a moment that I actually remember where Liam Neeson comes to see Emma Thompson and, you know, is talking about how worried he is about his son. And she says to him, "My horrid son, Bernard." So that's where the Bernard comes in that one. The movie opens up with this great scene at the London Heathrow Airport, which was actually filmed with, you know, hidden cameras and whatnot. And they were, every time they saw somebody, you know, being greeted and, you know, it was a great emotional moment, they immediately raced over to, you know, get them to sign model releases and stuff like that. And I saw this movie at the Charles when it came out. you might have even been there, Mike, in the same theater at the same day, when one of the guys who had been in one of the segments that they had come up to say, you know, we want to use this in this movie coming up, you know, introduced it, said what it would look like. And then it opened up and we saw all these little vignettes of people, and it wasn't, you know, the guy who had done any, you know, done the intro. But after the movie, when it comes back to that and they showed several segments, you did get to see him, and the whole audience clapped and was just so happy for him. It's just, I associate so much of a good experience watching this movie with the experience of having actually seen the movie in the theater, and it was very powerful. But it then starts off with a bunch of different vignettes setting up all the characters and how they're interrelated. And I wanted to mention that if you watch that opening sequence where you get to the wedding scene, that Richard Curtis has a cameo in there as the trombone player. And he got the idea for the surprise of the band singing All You Need Is Love from Jim Henson's funeral, which he had attended, where all the puppeteers brought their Muppets and sang a song. So I think this is where he hits his stride. And I think maybe it's because he got to direct and write, but I think this movie turned out just so charmingly. It's a, you know, tradition for some people to, you know, watch it every year at Christmas, and, you know, each of the different characters where, you know, you're following their story. You know, if it doesn't turn out well, you know, you're hoping on the subsequent viewings that they're going to make a different choice. Of course they don't, but it's just a wonderful movie with wonderful performances. And they did come back, you know, with a, you know, sort of a Where Are They Now sort of recap movie, which was nice. You know, it's nice to see the closure for that. Do you want to say any more about Love Actually before we talk about Time?
Yeah, I did want to say a bit more about Love Actually. In that film, in addition to doing the screenplay and being the co-producer, roles he'd been playing, when I say roles here, I mean, you know, behind the camera roles, this is the first movie, as Marie mentioned, this is his directorial debut. So he's totally in control of this film. In terms of working with, you know, a really good cast, look at some of the talent attached to that film. There's Hugh Grant, of course, Rowan Atkinson, Bill Nighy, Keira Knightley, Alan Rickman, Colin Firth, Emma Thompson, Laura Linney, Liam Neeson. I mean, just on that way. What with the interwoven storylines, it does have a relatively long running time. I think maybe a little too long. There's just a lot going on. It's constantly handing off with the narration and so on. There's so much packed into it that actually, ironically, get a wedding and a funeral in this film, and just in the first few minutes. I mean, it's just a whole lot packed in. I don't share the disparagement completely of New York Times critic A.O. Scott when he referred to the film as an indigestible Christmas pudding, but there are times where I think it's a bit cloying, and that's a word I'll use in talking about a lot of Richard Curtis's work. It's funny, it's sweet, it's silly, and sometimes maybe just pushes a little too far with that, or just a little too insistently. But before we move ahead further, I want to backtrack just very briefly, because Love Actually came out in 2003, but leading up to that are a couple of films that should definitely be mentioned. One is Notting Hill from 1999, in which he does the screenplay and co-produces, because again, you've got, you know, Hugh Grant, and playing across from Julia Roberts. And, you know, he plays a bookstore owner, she plays a movie star. She does that well. She knows how to play a movie star. And their relationship has something of what's been called like a Roman holiday type quality. And it, you know, there's some sweetness there in the romantic interplay between them. The other film I'd want to mention before we jump ahead beyond Love Actually would be Bridget Jones' Diary from 2001. This is a case where, you know, he's adapting a screenplay from a best-selling novel and working with, you know, Hugh Grant again, but also Renee Zellweger, Colin Firth, and so on. So working with British actors and also American actors, and the fact that there's that kind of romantic comedy that does so well that Bridget Jones' Diary did extremely well at the box office. It really played well and led to some sequels and so on. And the storyline itself has a kind of Pride and Prejudice quality to it. I'm not a big fan of the film particularly, but it's enjoyable and gives you a sense of what I call the dynamics of a Richard Curtis screenplay in terms of the male and female lead characters, the kind of complications that go into a kind of screwball comedy, a lot of the complications and things, the silliness of it. And ultimately, and very sweetly, things will end quite happily. So those are two films, Notting Hill and Bridget Jones Diary, that actually lead up to Love Actually. And in that case, you know, he is, as we've said, in the director's chair for the first time. So he's got like total control. And in his subsequent films, sometimes he's the director, sometimes, as I said before, he'll hand off to someone else. But in any event, you know, these are Richard Curtis products, and he's very much the creative force behind them. So even if the public still doesn't entirely know his name quite as well as it might, enough people will know the name, and they certainly know the films at that point.
Worth noting about Notting Hill is that the bookshop was actually an antique shop in real life and next to a butcher. And a couple doors down from the butcher's is an office for Richard Curtis's production company. Before becoming a superstar, singer Adele actually bought the flat directly above the bookshop. She didn't live there that long. I wanted to mention also that he wrote the script for War Horse in 2011. And I just wanted to mention this quote from him about Steven Spielberg phoning him up one day and saying, "What bit are you working on?" And he said, "I am the horse." He's like, "What do you mean?" And he says, "Well, unless we are clear what the horse is thinking all the time, it is going to be tougher for you." And I remember thinking very hard about what the horses would feel when they were first taken away by German soldiers and first saw dead horses by the roadside and how frightening that would be. So that gives you like a little bit of insight into his, you know, thinking about writing scripts and maybe why he's so good at it. Before we run out of time, I want to mention About Time, a movie I kind of just stumbled across on Netflix and started watching. You know, this is also written and directed by Richard Curtis, and it's a time travel movie. And he said, you know, everybody's always interested in time travel, maybe because, you know, we all think about what would be different if we could go back in time and change something. And it's an interesting idea because, you know, you can only move within your own lifetime to places you've already been and you can't travel into the future. When you travel back in time, you can return back to the point you originally set out from. If you've already been there, then you've messed with the way the future works. It's a very interesting way to set up the whole idea about that movie. I think it's a fantastic movie, reprising some of his favorite actors too, like Bill Nighy. It's great to see Bill Nighy in a completely different role than he plays in Love Actually. And I'm going to let you say whatever you want to say about Time, Mike, and then we should probably close with Yesterday.
Well, one reason why I appreciate that film and also appreciate his screenplay for War Horse is it gets him out of what had become a bit of a creative rut. By that, I mean, if you look at his more recent screen credits, there's Bridget Jones, The Edge of Reason, you know, a sequel. There's Mr. Bean's Holiday, a sequel. In other words, he's hitting that button to work with the same character, the same storylines and so on. And for me, it's the law of diminishing returns. I mean, these more recent retreads, if you will, these sequels, they're okay, but they're not as good as what the original films were. They start to just be a little too familiar at that point. So I can really appreciate a film like the screenplay for War Horse because it's totally different material. You know what I mean? It takes him out of that and he has to stretch himself a bit. And so that's why I think, you know, at this point in his career, he can hit that button and just do the greatest hits, if you will, the greatest characters, or he can try some different things. So in terms of different things, I think Pirate Radio is an example of where he's working with a somewhat different kind of story and, you know, familiar elements and some actors he's worked with before. But it seems to me that, you know, and to his credit, he's stretching a bit creatively in terms of, because Pirate Radio is all about a pirate radio operation off the coast of England, you know, counter programming to the BBC, if you will. And, you know, it's based on a true story and it's relatively observant. And I'm not crazy about it as a film, but I do admire the way in which he's trying to break out of just doing the same few things that he's known for in terms of types of comedy. It's different that way. So I think actually, you know, as a writer, a director, a producer, a multi-hyphenate, if you will, he's showing a kind of versatility with what he can do.
Well, that brings me to 2019's Yesterday, where he is now the writer, screenplay. But the director is Danny Boyle, which I think is a great combination. You know, Danny Boyle, probably best known for Slumdog Millionaire. And of course, Richard Curtis is, you know, screenwriter extraordinaire. So I think that was always, you know, going to work. The premise that, you know, this guy wakes up after he's been in an accident and nobody can remember the Beatles because they don't exist in this alternative timeline where he, you know, starts the movie off from. And that's actually based on something that really happened to Paul McCartney in 1966. McCartney fell from his moped and chipped a front tooth in Liverpool and cut his lip and, you know, got a scar. So it starts off with a little bit of Beatles lore and then just sort of takes off from there with just interesting things that do not exist in this universe, like Coca-Cola and cigarettes. And originally they were going to come up with this idea that the color purple was one of the things that no longer existed, you know, with a casual reference to the band Deep Purple being called Deep Orange. But that they had to abandon that because it'd be too much work to make sure that no extras showed up on set wearing purple. So, Mike, how did this movie strike you? Is it a Danny Boyle movie or is it a Richard Curtis movie?
That's a great question. It's both, actually. Push come to shove, I'd give more of the credit to, well, for the premise, you got to give credit to the screenwriter. And it's one of those wacky premises. You take it or leave it, right? I mean, if you don't buy it or don't, you know, it's talk about suspension of disbelief. You just have to go with it. And I went with it sufficiently to enjoy it. And so I think, you know, the premise, you know, that's Richard Curtis' kind of daffy temperament. So credit there. In terms of the film otherwise and overall, I'd give more of the credit to the director, Danny Boyle, at that point, because it actually is a well-made film, well-paced and just well thought out. And a lot of that on a more technical level speaks to a director who I think is probably a bit more talented when it comes to thinking conceptually, thinking visually by way of how to frame a shot, how to move the camera, how to cut. Not that Richard Curtis doesn't do all those things when he's in the director's chair, but Marie, don't you think that somehow Danny Boyle just has a little more spirit, a little more smarts, if you will, in terms of what you can do by way of telling that story? What do you think?
I think that's a great point, for one thing, because it's not in the original script, but once Danny Boyle saw that there was a recording studio by a railroad track, that he actually altered the text to incorporate the trains and utilize the location as Gavin's studio. That's the kind of instinctive thing that you know is going to not only, you know, get across the, you know, early salad days of the band, but also just, it's just a great emotional punch. It gives it, you know, it gives an extra sound as well that's not music. It's just it's very well done. I want to mention, by the way, since we are running out of time, that when Jack first performs Yesterday, his friends say that it's not as good as Coldplay. That's because Ed Sheeran's role was originally meant for Chris Martin, who is the lead singer of Coldplay, who couldn't do it. So they offered it to Sheeran and they left the joke in the script. And there's lots of little moments like that that are just so pleasurable that, and of course, hearing all the great Beatles music and, you know, the whole idea of, you know, what if there was a different world? What if there are alternative universes? You know, what would be the implications of that? And if you knew about both of them, what could you take advantage of because you belong to both worlds? So that brings us to the end of our segment. Don't forget to check out our other podcasts at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com. And we will see you at the movies.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.